and welcome to another edition of Drug Fix, the Pink Sheet's Pharma Regulatory Podcast. I'm Derek Gingery, an executive editor at the Pink Sheet, and I'm joined by senior writer Sarah Carlin Smith, senior editor Sue Sutter, and editor-in-chief Nielsen Hobbs. Today is April 26, 2024. Let's jump right in with our first story. Sarah, you wrote an interesting piece about a new FDA guidance on biosimilar promotion. So what did we find out?
Sure. So one of the big changes or updates in the guidance, which was issued initially in 2020, is that they're trying to focus more on sort of specifically addressing interchangeability. And FDA is pretty clear that, you know, you cannot promote an interchangeable as sort of superior in safety or efficacy to a biosimilar that doesn't get that designation. And it's just, it's interesting because there's sort of a broader push at FDA now and by the Biden administration, HHS overall, to look at dropping, you know, this sort of two different classes of, you know, biosimilars and just sort of essentially say everything is interchangeable, which will be interesting going forward. I mean, the FDA has sort of seems to be suggesting, you know, the science around what we know about these products have changed. And, you know, I think there's been concern about lack of interchangeability designations in particular being kind of abused and hampering uptake of these cheaper products. And of course, the rest of the world never had this sort of strange system that I think is quite confusing to explain intellectually to people. So I thought that was notable that there's this bigger sort of trend around, you know, how FDA wants to handle these, you know, copycat biologic products.
Yeah, that was my thought too, because the FDA has now made clear that they want this dropped. They want interchangeability dropped, and they want legislation to do it. It was in their budget request. So, but the interesting question is that I thought of after reading through your story was, you know, are there like non-legislative ways for them to kind of make interchangeability either less relevant or kind of put it to the wayside? And, you know, is kind of this guidance sort of a step in that direction? I don't know if it's a huge step, but this seems like one of maybe, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 things that they could do. And at the end, if the legislation, they just can't get it passed for one reason or another, you know, there's just nothing, no vehicle or something, you know, you've made it so interchangeability is kind of, you know, it's still there, but it's not really relevant anymore. I don't know. I mean, I'm just throwing it out there.
I think there are several parallel tracks that the FDA and the administration is working on. One, as you said, they sort of kind of have this formal legislative request, although I haven't seen language. I'm not sure it's sort of kind of at that stage yet to sort of kind of to remove the designation. That would be sort of kind of perhaps the cleanest and easiest way to do it, except that sort of kind of nothing can get through Congress, so that would not be clean and easy at all. And you know, what would the vehicle be? I suppose if there was sort of, you know, a CBO score that could show that that's sort of the removing the designation saves money, could sort of kind of be folded in some other larger health bill. And then there's sort of the track that Sarah wrote about this week, that you know, the FDA is trying to sort of downplay the significance of interchangeability. You know, we saw, I guess it was middle of last year, that they are changing how they label biosimilars. So we're going to not talk about, well, this one's sort of interchangeable and this one's sort of kind of not, and what have you. So that's sort of kind of that the distinction is sort of kind of, you know, blurred sort of kind of both on the formal labeling and into kind of what companies can say about it, you know, for in terms of advertising, as they said in this most recent guidance. And then there's the tack that they're also taking that I know Sue's written a bunch about in terms of her what she's been able to find out looking at you know, review memos and the like, is that they will go ahead and designate products interchangeable even without her kind of what everyone was expecting them to have to do, which is the big, you know, comparative clinical studies that sort of kind of you know, to get that designation. So they're sort of moving in all these ways as we're kind of to really sort of kind of make biosimilars you know, the standard as opposed to interchangeability, the standard they're not making it this high bar, not making it something you can shout about and the like.
Yeah, I think certainly they're doing everything they can administratively in the absence of legislative language on this.
The one thing like to obviously think about here is the interchangeability is a very valuable, I think, distinction for in particular like outpatient products, right? Because it allows for that automatic substitution at the pharmacy level. So, you know, and thinking about, you know, what Sue has written about in terms of them sort of making it easier for companies to get that designation, that's really important because the option doesn't seem to be to go to everything is just a biosimilar. Even if FDA wants to sort of downplay that something is interchangeable or not in their labeling for, you know, uptake and reimbursement purposes, I think that and this is how state laws work in terms of substitution and so forth, that is an important designation to have.
I mean, at some point it may, you know, the system may evolve and, you know, we need to make clear biosimilars are not generics. They're never intended to be generics. They're just completely different molecules, so they can't behave like the generic industry or system does. But the system could eventually evolve to where FDA says at approval, this is interchangeable. And, you know, just like you get generics get a rating when they're approved. If, you know, AB is what you want, I believe, if I'm remembering it correctly, that says substitutable, you know, interchangeable with everything. So, you know, the big question is, when will all the people inside the FDA become comfortable with movement in that direction if they want to move that far? You know, I remember interviewing Sarah Yim a couple years ago, asking her about this, and she was saying, FDA is a really big ship, and it, you know, when you turn the rudder, it takes a while for the ship to kind of change the direction. So there's a whole lot of people that need to kind of get comfortable and sign off, not, you know, formally sign off, but, you know, kind of get in the right mindset that this is okay. And, you know, the implication was a couple years ago that they weren't there yet. Well, it seems like they're moving pretty quickly for FDA standards if they're getting more comfortable with it.
I mean, it seems like FDA is there. They put in their budget request to do this. So, I mean, they are there. I mean, maybe there's individual people that aren't there, but they are there. But it seems like they don't believe they have the power to do this fully on their own, or at least.
Yeah, just think about how much FDA's approach has changed. We're recording on the day that FDA put out this release about the 50th biosimilar being approved. And remember when we covered the first one getting reviewed, there was an advisory committee. And, it was treated as sort of like this whole, you know, sort of a complicated thing that's really needed outside experts that we're going to thoroughly vet. And now they're in the situation where they're administratively deciding something is interchangeable. It's a rapid evolution from that. And, as everyone else has said, that, there's only so far they can go administratively. And obviously there's sort of kind of momentum that has to be built there. But, I think the next big step would be sort of legislation, as Sarah noted. That's sort of kind of really going to, change the reimbursement landscape if they're not just going to kind of automatically make everything interchangeable for the heck of it.
Sarah, turning back to the promotional aspects of the guidance that you covered, I thought it was interesting this morning you flagged in a tweet a statement from Cigna regarding something along the lines of not all biosimilars are created equal, and you suggesting that FDA might take issue with that statement. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I just thought it was funny after reading, Cigna was... Cigna has put out some news today that they're going to cover certain Humira biosimilars at a $0 copay, if with the caveat, of course, that they're going to send you got to go through their specialty pharmacy to get them. But that's pretty big news in that space. But they also had an executive in one of the stories I read, right, making that comment, which seems right, counter to what FDA was trying to emphasize in the guidance and counter to, again, sort of probably at least a decade of FDA and other sort of education around this. Now, I guess, you know, to Derek's point around, you know, there are certain ratings even that come with generics. And sometimes, you know, there are certain products maybe that are have gotten nicks, I guess, because of certain issues, like quality issues and so forth. But for the most part, right, once FDA is saying, once we approve a biosimilar, you know, you should view it as clinically, you know, substitutable for the biologic. And so it's strange to see this messaging coming from the insurance space in some ways, and yet also kind of, I think, also not completely surprising, because I think in some ways, FDA having this, or the U.S. Having this biosimilar interchangeability sort of dual process has kind of added to the confusion of what it means to be a biosimilar and makes it kind of intellectually hard to grasp. And of course, Humira is sort of interesting too, because there are different sort of dosages and formulations. So maybe they're talking about that, some of the, you know, just different qualities of the various versions of Humira. But
there's also versions that are interchangeable and some that aren't. So yeah, there are you know, how many are there? Eight or nine Humira biosimilars. Yeah, some of them are interchangeable, have the designation, and some of them don't. So it's even more confusing.
Right. And I think it's hard to, like, intellectually to convey to people who don't know much about this space to say, well, you know, all the biosimilars are clinically the same, but yet we've given some of these added, you know, little sort of perk. Doesn't really make sense. So you're saying, but, like, they're all the same, they're all fine, but yet this one's different. You know, I think it does become, you know, just a challenging sort of health communications challenge for the public. So I don't know. I mean, I think this is something that, you know, the mistake was made quite a long time ago to, in terms of how this process was, you know, sort of established for these sort of two tiers of the system.
I mean, I'm going to date myself here because I remember, it must have been like 2011, something like that, where it was one of the first public meetings that they had when they were creating, they were putting the biosimilar pathway together, and they were talking about, you know, various issues with approving them because they hadn't approved any yet. And everyone was talking about one thing, and one person stood up during the public comment portion and said, I believe all biosimilars should be interchangeable. And that I remember all the reporters running over to that person and being like, what do you mean? That's, you know, such a foreign concept compared to like the other 200 people in the room that were talking. So, you know, it's funny that we've come full circle now, all the way back to that.
Well, that was sort of always the generic industry's positions for kind of even in negotiating the initial biosimilar pathway, is that sort of kind of they thought that there should not be this interchangeability distinction, and you know, they sort of lost in Congress, and sort of kind of you know, FDA for many years were kind of was sort of kind of following the spirit, and if not the and the letter of the law. Now they obviously have to stick to the letter of the law, but they're you know, they sort of kind of their scientific spirit has moved towards sort of kind of perhaps that that commentator's idea that you talked to all that time ago, Derek.
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion for sure. So thanks, Sarah. It's a very, very fun thing to watch. Next, we're going to look at gene therapies and accelerated approval. Sue, Peter Marks gave a preview of what CBER is going to put in an upcoming guidance. What did he talk about?
So, yeah, on a recent Alliance for a Stronger FDA webinar that was really focused on CBER's budget and its budget request, he talked about some of CBER's priorities for calendar year 2014, and one of those he listed was to develop a draft guidance on use of accelerated approval for gene therapies. And then in his kind of subsequent commentary, he talked about how there's really three buckets of types of applications that he sees that may be addressed in this guidance. And those that are sort of very low-hanging fruit, he described them. Something such as where a case where a gene therapy results in the production of hemoglobin, you know, in somebody with hemophilia or beta thalassemia, and then, you know, so that's a great biomarker, reasonably likely to predict clinical benefit, low-hanging fruit. And then the second sort of low-hanging fruit was where you can't measure anything directly with a gene therapy product, but you can measure something kind of upstream or downstream, a marker, and that marker is reasonably likely to predict an effect in either an animal model or a human. So that's also another situation where their accelerated approval would be a good fit. And then the third case was sort of everybody else, where things are going to get more challenging. And so I think the way he talked is this guidance is going to address sort of these three buckets of situations. So it's going to help sponsors figure out what bucket they're in and what challenges they're facing when they consider the regulatory pathway that they want to go down. This is all part of CBER's efforts to, as Peter Mark says, lean in to accelerate approval, especially around rare diseases. And he also made some interesting comments on the use of accelerated approval. He considers it a calculated risk. And he said, you know, if we get this right 19 times out of 20 with an accelerated approval, if that 20th time we have to take a drug off the market because it doesn't confirm clinical benefit, he said, that's okay. And he's not going to lose any sleep over that.
So I want to get back to the whole I'm not going to lose sleep thing in a minute. But in terms of, I'm assuming industry knows what the low-hanging fruit are with gene therapies at this point. They're planning their pipelines decades in advance. So I'm sure that's worked out. But would a guidance like this drive development in one direction or another? I mean, I'm guessing that's probably, I don't even know if that's the point or not, but they kind of sometimes have these unintended, you know, consequences of doing something like that.
Well, Derek, I think you wrote a story a couple of months back that where some, it might have been Peter Marks or somebody else from CBER, talked about how pretty much from here on in, accelerated approval is going to be on the table from the beginning. It's going to be under discussion from the beginning, right? Not further mm-hmm. down in the development program, not sort of as a de facto fallback. So I think this will help set up those discussions. You know, as companies are sort of very, very early in their development programs, okay, where do we fall? You know, are we in the low-hanging fruit? Are we in the middle-hanging fruit? Or are we way up there, you know, with some issues that are likely to be challenging? And I think that's going to influence their interactions with the FDA. I think FDA wants companies to understand where they fall before they come in and talk to the agency.
Or better yet, not try to make it clear that you can't just put yourself in the low-hanging fruit bucket if you're not supposed to be there.
Right.
Because, yeah, we've heard often that companies have different views of where they should go in these kinds of discussions than the FDA often does.
Right. And they have different views than the FDA sometimes in terms of the extent to which their particular surrogate or biomarker is reasonably likely to predict clinical benefit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wanted to get back to Peter Marks not losing sleep, which, you know, is laudable. This whole idea that, you know, he understands and he likes to make clear. I've heard him say it a couple times now about this idea. If, you know, we're going to do these through accelerated approval, get ready, because not all of them are going to be effective and we're going to have to start withdraw them. And he's saying, like, if that happens once in a while, I'm okay with that. I'm just wondering if withdrawals in general still, even though they're supposed to become more common and we're supposed to be getting used to it, it doesn't seem like we get used to these ever. So, you know, I guess I'm wondering if he's, you know, the whole I'm not going to lose sleep if I have to pull one of these off the market is going to be, you know, a little different maybe in practice.
Well, of course. I mean, these things are still very cumbersome to go through, these withdrawals. However, you have Peter Marks saying this, and Peter Marks was the one who just presided over the Pepaxto withdrawal. He was the designated official who made that decision that Pepaxto, which is a CDER-regulated cancer drug, should be withdrawn. And that was withdrawn under the new sort of quote-unquote expedited withdrawal procedures of the Omnibus Reform Act. So he's not without knowledge of what is involved in withdrawing a drug. Now, in the case of having them withdraw, say, a gene therapy for a rare pediatric disease, one could see how that would be an incredibly challenging and emotional process.
Yeah, especially if the patients can't take another gene therapy with the vector because they're, you know, because of the immune system issues with it.
Well, and just the whole idea of, you know, if you're going to have an advisory committee before a withdrawal decision is proposed, and you're going to have a very active open public hearing with patients and their families, much more so than you saw in the case of Pepaxto. So yeah, that's going to be still an incredibly challenging process. But a point he also made, and this is the first that I have heard him say this, he may have said it in other venues, is that he would rather put a product out there under accelerated approval, give people an opportunity to have it, and then even if it fails to confirm clinical benefit, he'd rather do that than have people go down the right to try route. Because at least if something's going out there under accelerated approval, FDA is confident in the quality and the purity and the potency of that product. And they have also done a safety assessment of that product. You know, that has not happened. That does not happen under right to try.
I thought that was an interesting comment because he sort of ignored the other pathways people can get access between right to there's a big gap between right to try and accelerated approval, and that is obviously clinical trials and, you know, expanded access, where I think most people argue those are the preferred ways over right to try for patients to get access to experimental drugs, but they also come with more protections in some ways for patients than a product that's gone through the FDA approval process, right? Because you're still able to gather data in a different way that usually ends up being helpful long-term, and you're also insulated from the extremely high costs that we expect for some of these gene therapies. So I thought it was a little bit, I mean, I get what he's saying, and I think most people in the regulatory space are not big fans of right to try. Right to try really hasn't been used much at all for a variety of reasons, but it seemed like that was like a little bit of an unfair comparison given the other ways people have to get access. And it just felt like to me like he also just sort of downplays to some degree some of the uniqueness about gene therapy. Like he plays up the uniqueness of the patient population some of these gene therapies will go to in terms of, you know, really maybe not having any access to any treatments or the like high morbidity or mortality of the diseases, but not without sort of maybe thinking about the trade-offs that come from, you know, choosing one gene therapy over another and, you know, the choices people are going to be making without maybe all the information you might like to have, which again, I don't know, we don't live in this perfect world and, you know, people are always making trade-offs like that, but it's a little bit different for like a cancer drug accelerated approval, where in most cases, right, you try a drug, it doesn't seem to be, you know, changing the course of your disease. It's often very easy to kind of switch treatment courses. And with these gene therapies, that's not the same in terms of, you know, how you kind of treat and your future options.
Right. To Derek's point, if you get an AAV gene therapy once, you cannot get another AAV gene therapy, at least at this stage of the evolution of the science.
And if it's, I mean, my understanding, I mean, and say the product causes some kind of, you know, adverse problem, you know, is there sort of a way to course correct, you know, in the same way, right, when you can, you know, go off a drug or so forth?
Yeah, that precluding another gene therapy is so far a theoretical risk, just because my sense is there are not sort of kind of multiple gene therapies for these conditions yet. Obviously, it's where you hope that sort of kind of things develop along those lines. But you know, it's not like for people having to choose and sort of kind of, you know, one's under accelerated approval and one's you know, under the old stodgy traditional approval and what have you. But you know, I think that Marx is right in terms of his philosophical approach here, that sort of kind of that there is a distinction between the accelerated approval pathway and the traditional you know, full FDA approval, if you will. I mean, the reason they're the statute exists is that we're kind of to take these risks, and so you know, that he's sort of kind of embracing it and perhaps engaging in a bit of a rhetorical sleight of hand, as you noted, Sarah. That's you know, what you'd want someone who's for kind of you know, is an employing for kind of all the tools at his disposal to get products to patients to be doing. And you know, you can always argue, well, he's for kind of you know, sort of drawing the line not where he should, but it's not like sort of kind of you know, companies are lining up to sort of kind of offer you know, either for right to try or expanded access programs, and sort of he's saying, no, we have to go accelerated approval. He's sort of reflecting the reality, as you noted, Sarah, that sort of kind of that you know, because of this, we're kind of this you know, sort of reimbursement issue, that sort of kind of that the you know, the firms are not doing these other things, and you know, if that's what the statute says that you know, sponsors can do, then let's embrace it and see see what comes of it.
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion, but I'm still not convinced that, especially with how people have short memories when they argue for access, and then when you give them access and it doesn't work, then you immediately get criticized for providing access to something that didn't work. So I think the blowback on some of these might be a little worse than maybe some are anticipating, which ironically leads us to our final story today, which is on FDA's interactions on Capitol Hill. While the partisan rancor seems like normal course of business now, the FDA used to be somewhat excused from it. Mike McCann of Prevision Policy wrote a piece reminding us that there used to be days when the FDA's work was celebrated on both sides of the aisle and not just the one in power. And he was arguing that that honeymoon is apparently over. FDA Commissioner Robert Califf endured many questions during a recent House oversight hearing on, you know, where members were suggesting that the COVID vaccine should not have been given an emergency use authorization, and that the agency's stance against using ivermectin as a COVID treatment was questioned. Representative Paul Gosar even asked Califf if he would like to express regret for failing to curtail the chronic disease epidemic in the country. Members also criticized so-called revolving door with industry, where officials leave the agency and work for pharma. I don't know. I mean, you all have covered a lot of these hearings. I know I've been to a bunch of them over the years, and I don't remember them ever being complete, you know, kind of, I don't know, you know, just kind of bland and boring, and, you know, not really having any kind of, you know, controversy associated with them. But I mean, do you think it's getting worse now, especially for the FDA?
Bit of issue with Mike's narrative, because I don't think FDA is a stranger to stern sort of questioning, or members of Congress from both sides of the aisle, you know, really doing a lot of oversight and having issues with their decision making compared to, say, an agency like NIH, which I think Congress tends to have like a harder time criticizing, although COVID sort of changed that. You know, I think to me, it's more like the thing that was a little bit striking at this hearing and a couple of other hearings where FDA wasn't necessarily present, but their, you know, work was sort of involved in the criticism, is just the degree to which Republicans are particularly, or some, I think it's not, you know, some faction of the Republican Party on Capitol Hill is still very, seems to be overtly anti-science and anti-vaccine and, you know, questioning well, still the approval, you know, then the authorization, now the approval of the COVID vaccines and so forth. I think that's like a bit, that's where I see the difference versus, you know, more, I guess, which you could say as maybe like kind of legitimate disagreements to sort of around like policy, you know, again, like we just talked about accelerated approval. I think there's always going to be some amount of right judgment call around, you know, what the threshold is for certain decisions FDA makes, right? And people of different kind of political beliefs and persuasions are not always going to agree with FDA. They're never going to please everybody there. But like, there are certain things where FDA should be able to kind of make like the scientific case for certain products and, you know, the number of lives saved by the COVID vaccines. And that's where I find this to be particularly concerning, especially with Califf's, you know, sort of stated goals and efforts to combat misinformation. You know, it's one thing to have to combat it, I think, with the sort of general public, but then if you're, if the leaders, you're sort of also the other leaders that you're, the public is interacting with are spreading these messages, I think that makes FDA's job even harder.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you get the feeling, at least in the past, that they would ask those questions just specifically so FDA could debunk them, you know, like they, because they wouldn't ask them in like an attacking tone. It would be like, you know, I'm hearing this. Is this, you know, that's not the case, right? Or something like that, you know. And but yeah, like you said, yeah, I sat through a lot of contentious hearings, too. I went to the House hearing on the compounding scandal. And actually the Senate hearing too, back in, what was that, 2012 or 2013, something like that. And, you know, hours and hours and hours, and both parties were not nice to then Margaret Hamburg was the commissioner. And, you know, to a certain extent, FDA deserved some, you know, deserved it, you know, because of all the, everything that happened and wasn't done. And, you know, you used to hear a lot of the same criticism over and over about opioids and why are you still approving new, you know, new non-abuse deterrent opioids and things like that. And, you know, what are you doing about this and those sorts of things. But, yeah, I don't know if it's just a, this is, I mean, I don't know if it's like a new generation of lawmakers is coming in and, you know, this is kind of their, you know, the way, you know, they're kind of more attacking, you know, posture is kind of just the way they want to do these things or, if, you know, I don't know. Or if it's just, or if it's something else, like you said, Sarah, I don't know.
Yeah, Sarah, I really like your emphasis on the COVID as sort of kind of the inflection point for this. I think we're kind of before this, you could obviously sort of kind of count on Republicans to criticize a Democratic FDA commissioner for what have you. But for the most part, they would you know, trust, if not the not trust the science, they would sort of kind of encourage a trust into kind of you know, the scientifically focused corporations. And I feel like that sort of kind of has at least a rhetorical sense, sort of kind of gone away in terms of sort of how they're approaching hearings now. And so it's there's no place in which they're kind of, you know, part of the FDA ecosystem is sort of kind of has a, has at least sort of a, an overt friend on these hearings.
On that inspiring note, we'll wrap it up for today. For more, check out our website at www.thepinksheet.com. You can also find this and other podcasts on the Sightline channel in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and Spotify Podcasts, as well as smart speakers if they are your default podcast provider. Thanks again for listening to Drug Fix. I'm Derek Ingery with Sarah Carr-Smith, Sue Sutter, and Nielsen Hobbs. Take care, and we'll see you next time.